everything is gone. Everything is gone. The clothes on my back is all I own. Everything is gone. The clothes on my back is all I own.
Can you read my sign? My senses help me, please. Get me off this rooftop. Can somebody rescue me? Can you hear the people crying? Crying in despair. Each day we're losing hope. Does anybody care?
This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. On today's show, come hell or high water, Hurricane Katrina and the color of disaster, with Dr. Michael Eric Dyson. Just think, it took the weather, literally and figuratively, to riff off the roof of America's two biggest taboos, race and class. Dyson chronicles what happened and argues that the nation's failure to offer aid to Katrina's victims indicates the depths of the problem in race and class relations. His contention that Katrina exposed a dominant culture pervaded not so much by active malice towards poor blacks, but by a long history of passive indifference, is powerful and a harbinger that should the warnings go unheeded, the next storm we face will involve more than just wind and rain. We're already at the high water mark.
Once again, the color of my skin reminds me things ain't changed.
Thank you so kindly for the wonderful invitation to come to Reed College in Portland, Oregon, where the living is easy and the burden is light. And to talk about some critical issues of American society. And the topic is Come Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster. When we think about the scenes that the nation saw in the immediate aftermath of one of the most horrendous natural disasters to beset American society, we are reminded that we are all, to some degree, alienated from the everyday existence of the impoverished in this culture. To a certain degree, such ignorance is an investment in moral immaturity, for it denies us culpability that knowledge brings. The imprimatur of some ethical demand that refuses to go away will not be washed away with the violent winds and vicious waters that were visited upon vulnerable populations in the Gulf Coast. Some of us have invested in that naivete as a way of forestalling the inevitable conclusion that we too have been complicit in the process of demoralizing or demonizing the poor, marginalizing them through the adoption of religious viewpoints that hold people personally accountable for the conscription in the war of poverty. But when it washes up on the shore, we can no longer deny our complicity in our religious beliefs that say God helps those who help themselves, in our political philosophies, which say that this is limited governance after all. The government should be there in a provisional feature to respond to the ills of society, but for the most part, we are here on our own, sink or swim. And the laissez-faire democracy, the marketplace that we think rules with an iron obligation to neutrality and is revealed for what it is, a social construct, an ideological projection of a political apparatus that is only self-interested to a certain degree and not interested in the chinks in the armor or the subversion of its own narrative, its truth-telling, because these machinations and machineries produce stories and narratives and myths that either sanctify or legitimate what they believe in. But many of us were able to be outraged in the aftermath of Katrina because we felt it did not implicate us. Aha, that was the state government. Aha, that was the local government. Aha, that was the federal government. And to be sure, there's plenty of blame to go around. And in my new book, I assign that blame. But it avoids the more nasty, inconvenient conviction of conscience that all of us should feel in the face of the fury that was visited upon those vulnerable populations. Populations, after all, we need remind ourselves, that were already vulnerable, left behind long before Katrina came to town. Mississippi is the poorest state in the nation, followed quickly by Louisiana. When we think about the fact that of the major places that were hit hardest by both the winds and subsequently the water in Katrina, that those places throughout the Gulf Coast had some communities that where 90,000 people made less than $10,000 a year, living each year, scraping by, taking the crumbs from the table. These are not lazy people who do not want to work. They are hard working, as you know. They are part of the working poor. They get up every day of their lives. And they work 40 and 50 and 60 hours a week, and yet they can barely make ends meet or barely make it above the poverty level. These people are not lazy, the shiftless that we, in one sense, consign them to be. We relegate them to the periphery of our consciousness because we feel somehow that these people are the unwashed masses, the undeserving poor, the social justifications that we deploy in defense of our inability or our disinterest or our disinclination to be involved, so that the constant devolution from the war on poverty to the war on the poor. And so years and years and years ago, we were capable of imagining a future that was radically different, dissimilar to the times we confront now, where those who are allegedly in defense of and speaking on behalf of the vulnerable are so careful and cautious and putting up fingers in the political winds to see if polls will justify their stances. While those who are convinced of the rightness of their cause, even if we oppose them tooth and nail, lack any such approbation, lack any such judicious, critical, Socratic wisdom or self-reflection, lack even the reflex to meditate upon the possibility that what they're doing is not right. And between the Scylla and Charybdis, between the precipitous inclines that we confront and the mountains we must scale in order to get to see the lives of the valley where the poor are consigned, the masses are there, peak to peak, we jump on elevated climbs of social theory and political philosophy, while down in the valley, people suffer in incredible fashion. We too are distant from them. And yet, the failure to imagine a different future for the poor, subject not only to right-wing assault, but by progressives and liberals and moderates who lack any ability to put spine into their spin, to stand up for once and just represent unapologetically those who have been distanced. All of this coming together, converging in a seamless garment that smothers the potential of those who are most vulnerable, the unorganized and yet perfectly astute conspiracy among disparate elements of political and social and theological communities, making the lives of the poor miserable and hell long before Katrina. And so when we look at the landscape, black poor people were already suffering. We don't really care about the poor rural whites either. We look at the Sago mines in West Virginia. It ain't like we really concerned about poor white southern rural folk. We look at them now on C-SPAN or CNN and we wonder how that lone miner is doing and we get outraged. But there was more of a fine, a greater amount assigned to CBS for the runaway breast of Janet Jackson. And then they were assigned a greater fine than the owner of the mine for those men who perished. And so we're not concerned about poor white people. We don't want to hear their stories. And so when Katrina came, in the Gulf Coast with those poor folk, we'd already abandoned them. We had already let them go. We had already consigned them to peripheries, black and white. We had come together to say that they were problematic. And so when we looked down there and saw that 134,000 people in New Orleans alone didn't have access to a car, they weren't stupid or stubborn. They were stuck. And some of them wanted to stay, however, because it's their home, it's their house. We visited a month ago a woman who came back having gone out in that storm-induced diaspora, as the New York Times phrased it. That storm-induced diaspora, but many diasporic experiences among Africans in America have been induced by one storm or another. Think of the 1927 Great Flood of Mississippi, where 154 work camps were established, where black people were forced into servitude, and then expanding the rim of that outer perimeter, if you will, of the great black migration, pushing it further so that Mississippi Negroes went up to Chicago, and Alabama and Georgia went to Detroit, and some from Texas went over to California and Los Angeles. And so, brothers and sisters, yeah, long time before that, these storm-induced diasporas occurred. And when we look at what happened there, we talked to this woman who had gone out into Houston but said FEMA was fouled up and messed her up. And people in Houston, black people, thinking that the crime rate elevated when they got there, like there wasn't no crime in Houston. There was some crime up in there long before those victims of the hurricane came there. But this is what happens. The vulnerable began to play musical chairs with the resources that the tune of the state plays, causing them to compete with each other and not seeing that the real enemy, the real opponent to their moral destiny, is indeed those with powers to hold purse strings and to call the tune to begin with. So poor blacks look at other poor blacks, and you can imagine being there in Houston, people going, hell, we ain't had no storm, but we poor too. We haven't had a storm to highlight our persistent inequality, our social injustice, the racial miasma that we have had to confront. So you can imagine some kind of player hating going on, some jealousy. Why are you giving them the concern? And then you can imagine some of the folk coming in from New Orleans thinking, damn, I just want to get back home. I ain't want to be up here with you either. I'm just trying to go along to get along. And so when we looked out on the horizon and saw what went down in Katrina, it wasn't just the question we had to ask, does George Bush care about black people? Duh. When Kanye West raised that question, he wasn't talking about George Bush, the individual. He don't know George Bush. He's talking about George Bush, the face of the government, George Bush, the titular representative of American democracy. He's speaking about George Bush, the collective identity, the institutional identity, the public persona that articulates our way of life. When people think about us, good God Almighty, they think about George Bush. That's the George Bush he's talking about, not individually. George Bush lived next door to you. I'm sure he'd help you take your trash out. He's a good neighbor. Like State Farm, he'll be there. And yet, if he ain't your neighbor, he'll make you buy the farm metaphorically in many ways. The point is that Mr. West is speaking about the collective and institutional identity. And he's not talking about care in terms of whether he's motivated passionately to be involved with you as an existential agent of your destiny. He's talking about care measured politically. How do you measure care in political terms? The timely distribution of critical resources to vulnerable populations. That's how you measure care politically. So doesn't care. George Bush doesn't care. Is the government doesn't respond in a timely fashion. That's the argument being made. And people got bent out of shape. Are you saying that white people looked at what was going on down there and said it's a bunch of Negroes? And we just don't care about the Negroes? Now, I'm sure some of them did. We is living in America. Don't act like I'm crazy. Right? When at the funeral of Coretta Scott King the other day that I attended, and the KKK is still protesting, we do be still living in America. So don't act like people who even thought that was the truth were crazy. The evidence is against y'all who think it ain't crazy. But even within the arena of, shall we say, good-thinking, fellow-feeling Americans, you don't even have to hold the fact that people were consciously racist or intentionally so to say that the consequences were troubling and traumatic. See, intent and consequence express an interesting and dynamic relationship. My pastor used to tell me a mosquito has the intent of getting blood, could have the consequence of giving you malaria. Intent, consequence, two damn different things when you break it down. And so race is not just racism. And racial intent does not get exhausted by racist practice. Race is a universe of perception that creates expectation, desire, and hierarchies of believability, accountability, desirability, and assigns value to who's worth looking for and who's not, and who's worth saving and who's not. Don't reduce it to a racist reflex that you can get out of with your liberal recognition. Understand the pervasive character of how race operates in America. Some people simply didn't see themselves, couldn't imagine who they were. But black people got a shock of recognition. That could be my mama. That's my uncle. That's my aunt. If a nation of women who look like Barbara Bush were down there, the government was so inept, it may not have gotten down there quicker, but it might have tried. That's the difference. The ineptitude, the inexperience, the ignorance, indeed the chronic cronyism of the Bush administration. My God, the philosophy of limited governance that says, according to Ronald Reagan, that the government is the enemy of the people may have prevented the successful removal and rescue of people from there, but they might have tried more quickly to get down there, because that's mama and grandmama, and most especially, that's us, that's us, that's we. That's down there, the proverbial pronouns that are evoked and evinced in the face of that horror might have shifted the terrain of consciousness. Maybe we would have tried to bend the rules a bit more. We see this in the face of Cheney. What I mean by that? I mean, you know, if that was Cheney having been shot by his companion, would we have stood for him to forestall the truth for so long? See, who you are when something happens is a big determinant of how we perceive what happens. So why are we going to deny that when it comes to poor black people? We don't deny that on other things. There's something about the visceral character, the palpable tension that we felt, the lack of identification with sorrow, pity, but not the ability to move as a government. Already the people had been abandoned, and yet this was a continuation of that abandonment by a governmental philosophy that says the public sphere should shred the safety net because people should stand up on their own 2 feet. And so the reality is that in the midst of all of this, this is how race operates. Senator Barack Obama said, I didn't see any racism. I didn't see active malice. I saw passive indifference. We might amend or at least adapt his language by saying, well, let's push that a little bit. Let's see how those are flip sides of the same coin. Passive indifference is a form of racial engagement or the failure to do so. And yes, the cues we get that we inherit, the collective racial unconscious that we inherit, the languages of nearness and intimacy and distance and pathologization, yes, all of that has to do with how we inherit vocabularies and rhetorics, racial sentiments generated. That's how complex this racial thing is. And when you add on that the class level, the assault on poor black people, and then all of a sudden ask why the government doesn't care. Why don't you care? And you know, generosity is one thing. Charity is one thing. Justice is another. Oh, America responded beautifully, gave $2 billion, matching nearly the $2.2 billion given in the aftermath of 9/11, although those survivors and their families got $2 million cold cash, no tax. Man, they can't even get $2,000 from FEMA. Wonder why they can't go back. It ain't going to be no chocolate city. People got upset with Mayor Nagin. They used to call him Mayor Reagan, with his political predilection toward the political conservatism that people now have remade him as a black folk hero. Slow down. Slow down. Right? Cross party lines to support Bobby Jindal, now the Republican congressman from that area, against Kathleen Blanco. That's why they had beef during the Katrina episode. Nagin himself, coming from corporate America, that ain't no knock against him, but never having served in public life at all, coming from Cox Cable to become the mayor, conservative agenda. That's why when they told him that Saturday night, they being the head of the National Weather Service, this is the worst storm I've ever seen coming, Nagin put off calling a mandatory evacuation till the next day. 6 o'clock, he was told Saturday night, Sunday at 10, he and the governor stood and called a mandatory evacuation. Why did he wait that long? He consulted with the business community first. Now, you are the mayor of the city, and you put the needs of corporate capitalism and the needs of entrepreneurship ahead of the citizens of your community. Ray Nagin did not care about poor black people either. So now that he looks like a folk hero because he cussed somebody out, cussing is called for. That's why I like Kanye West. I believe in cussing Christians. He cussed. He got some action. He said, don't send no damn press conference down here. Send some resource. Get on a plane and come down here. Don't fly over like Mr. Bush did. Donald Rumsfeld at the San Diego Padres game. Wow, the city was drowning. Condoleezza Rice went shopping for Ferragamo shoes. Ray Nagin sold those people short. And now he makes a chocolate city statement because his own Blue Ribbon Commission said, look, we're going to slow down for 3 and 4 months and let's determine what we're going to rebuild in New Orleans and what we won't be rebuilt. And you know what happens. The higher places among the white folk get rebuilt. The lower ones among the poor whites and the poor blacks don't get rebuilt. And that geography, that geographical disparity has been huge and of long-lasting nature in Louisiana from the time before the war and after the war of the states. That geography has been seen as high ground, has always been precious and assigned to those who were rich and white. So even those who claim, well, the storm was colorblind, yeah, but the consequence of living high or low weren't. I went to the Ninth Ward, it looks like Beirut. Looks like a bombed out war zone. Looks like the Middle East. Looks like Iraq. After we have laid waste to that terrain. And so now when he says it's Chocolate City, now I don't know about y'all, but 67.9% black before the storm, that's pretty darn chocolate. I mean, you know, come on. Of course it's a chocolate city. But see, partly Ray Nagin was not felicitous with the language. I mean, he borrowed the term from who? George Clinton. That's the funk aesthetic at the heart of political discourse. You got to have some skills. George Clinton was talking about what? Washington, D.C., chocolate city, vanilla suburbs. Now, the vanilla suburbs in New Orleans, the parishes as they call those counties, they were vanilla. They were restored to their demographic integrity prior to the storm. Ain't nobody mad at that. Right? Now, some white brothers and sisters got upset because he said as if to call it chocolate was to say we don't want white folk there. That's ridiculous. He needs the white folk up in there to at least get the concern of the government. Got to have the white folks. Come on in. By Jiminy Christmas, come back. Come on, white guys. Come on. Need the white brothers and sisters because that's their terrain, too. And it ain't no regular white folk. You're talking about Cajuns. You're talking about a different kind of white folk down in New Orleans. Can't tell. Are they black? Are they white? What are they? Who are they? How they talk? I can't get that rhythm. That's what it means to have French and Spanish and African coming together. That gumbo ya-ya. To be in New Orleans was to be always in an advanced state of intermingling, mestizo, and intervention of different races and ethnicities. The gumbo ya-ya pot of possibility. That's the beauty of New Orleans, even though it still had racial animus and hostility. So you ain't trying to dog the white folk. You just trying to say it's chocolate. But now it's just more than chocolate because you got Mexican workers being brought down there to clean up some stuff. And they were promised one wage and got another, but they ain't going to complain because some of them are undocumented. So they get exploited by Halliburton and KBR and Bechtel making $100 million no-bid contracts and successfully getting them in what Naomi Klein calls disaster capitalism. So don't worry about a chocolate city. Might be a peanut butter one, too. You got your chocolate in my peanut butter. You got your peanut butter in my chocolate. It's a Reese's Pieces racial and ethnic composition. So the point is that this is a complex terrain that we're speaking about when we talk about Hurricane Katrina, because what was washed to the fore was our failure to be ultimately committed to the most vulnerable. And my brothers and sisters, it is to our shame that we have allowed a situation to be as it is. So what will we do now? How will we respond? How will we rethink our presuppositions? How will we in our classes teach differently about those who are poor and vulnerable and those who are marginal and those who don't comport nicely with our theories, who don't fit in easily with our assumptions? How do we challenge ourselves to challenge the nation to think more critically and incisively about the vulnerable? And that's why I wrote this book, and that's why I try to engage in that discourse and conversation, because it's important for us to constantly open our minds and the vistas and horizons of our thinking to be related to the practices we engage politically. And so for me, it was important to be and see and hear there, to understand what was going on, to feel the people who had served me as I had gone down to New Orleans, as they served so many of us. So many of us had exploited these people, and so many of us had taken advantage of them, and yet we had not given back. And they're making $3 and $4 and $5 an hour without benefit of protection in a culture where health maintenance is preserved by going to the emergency room, because 45 million Americans are without health care, and many of them lived in New Orleans without such benefit. This is what we are confronting, the future of our face as Americans. And so I invite you, for us to come together and think critically, but beyond thinking, to render service in the face of the suffering of these most vulnerable. Thank you so very kindly. Thank you.
Then it hit me, ain't nobody coming to get me. No one feels my pain. Once again, the color of my skin reminds me things ain't changed.
You've been listening to a speech by Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, Come Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster. And the song you're now hearing is The Hurricane Song by Alan Waddy. This has been Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.